Well, good evening. Turn in your Bibles with me tonight to the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 9. Ecclesiastes 9. And 3:48 will be the song of encouragement after our study tonight. It is a blessing to be back and good to see everyone. We do have visitors with us, and we're most appreciative of your presence tonight. Thank you for stopping in and visiting with us. It's certainly an encouragement to us. And Cameron walked out. I was going to say, good job, Ashton, but he's done. He walked out, so get him a drink. I'm going to pick on him a little bit. But anyway, appreciate him and his efforts in leading singing. Brother Moore, I always do a great job. Appreciate the prayer tonight that was led. We're going to pick up our study once again in the book of Ecclesiastes chapter 9, and we're going to be examining our common end. That's what Solomon now turns his attention to, and he's already mentioned this a couple of times in the book. But since we have what we have, that is time right now, we need to be living it in a way that is pleasing to the Lord. And we are, though, always living in view of death, the end of the road. And it is reality, my friend, whether we want to accept it or not, it's the truth. Life has a way of throwing curveballs and has a way of giving us unexpected, out of the blue, difficulties and trials and tests. And so the key verse tonight in our study is going to be found actually in verse 11, where he says, I returned and saw unto the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor of men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. And that's something that we're going to be thinking about as we go through this study tonight. And just understand this, that whether you're rich or you're poor, whether you are smart or you're dumb, really, it doesn't matter. You're going to face difficulties and challenges in life, and especially one thing that happens to every single one of us, death. So as we have tried to emphasize in our study, let me just breeze through this real quick. Some of the things we've already talked about. This book is emphasizing what takes place under the sun. In other words, from this world's perspective. Now, certainly God is in view in the background, and as he gets to the end of the book, he's going to emphasize that. Our duty in this world is to please God, to fear him and keep his commandments. That's all that's really going to matter when all is said and done. But under this sun that we live on this earth under, we must live it in view of God. But everything here is temporary, and everything here is ultimately vanity. So the quest for satisfaction, people look in all the wrong places. We need to understand the fear of God. And there are things that are better than vanity. Live a life that is filled with honor and respect. Do what's right. Do good. Realize that the death day is even better than our birthday. Funeral is better than opportunity. When we think about things like we're going to be talking about tonight, it should cause us to reflect and hopefully motivate us to live a life that is godly in our desire and determination to please God. But in all of that, we must be wise, avoiding extremes and living a life of humility. And that's what we talked about last week. We need to realize that we are in a world that we are not in control of. Right? That we live in a world where wickedness surrounds us. Evil men exist. They do wicked and evil things. And then we also have a God to whom we must submit. And regardless of what happens to us in this life, regardless of how unfair this world may be, we still must fear God because we will ultimately answer to him. Beginning in verse 1 then in chapter 9. For I considered all this in my heart so that I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them. All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good, the clean, the unclean, to him who sacrifices and to him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath, as he who fears
an oath. This is an evil, and all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. But for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. And they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love, their hatred, and their envy have now perished. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. Go eat your bread with joy, and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white, and let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun. All your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life, and in the labor which you perform under the sun, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. For man also does not know his time. Like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare, so the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. Now really, as you think about what we just read, that's kind of gloomy, isn't it? It talks about death. It talks about difficulties and hardships and trials and troubles and all those things. And of course, the emphasis that's mentioned a few times in the text is that of death. Going back to verse 1, for I considered all this in my heart, the things that he has stated and the conclusions that he's reached. Now he's kind of mulling it all over. And the evidence that he has acquired to this point leads him to this conclusion. Our works are in the hand of God. And he's talking specifically in this context about the works of the righteous and the wise. Their works are in the hands of God. Listen, God is the one who allows all that happens to happen, but God is not micromanaging everything. But he does whatever happens. He does allow that to happen. And there are the things in life which we absolutely have no control over. We need to understand that, as we talked about in our last lesson. We need to be humble in this world. In fact, this world, if we learn what this world is supposed to teach us, we're going to learn humility. When we go through this world suffering and facing the hardships and the difficulties, it ought to teach us one important lesson. We don't have control over the things that happen in our life, the things that happen to us. The only thing that we actually control is what? Our response to those things. That's it. But what happens to us, we have no control over that. So here again, the sovereignty of God is being stressed. He leads us, he provides for us, he rewards the righteous, and our works and the things that we do are in his hands, okay? And we're doing it for his glory and for him. And he's going to reward the righteous and the faithful. But that reward does not typically come in this life. In fact, the overall reward doesn't. Notice he says that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them. What does he mean by that? The NIV gives a strange comprehension of this, but this is what I think he's talking about here. Does God love? The idea is approve of here. And sometimes the word hate is used, and not so much in that he despises something, but that he chooses one thing over another. But the real point is that the outward circumstances in this life are not the criteria by which we can judge whether a person is right with God or not. I think that's his point. And God does not differentiate between people in this life from the standpoint of the material things that they receive necessarily, because he makes it the sun to shine on both the just and the unjust. The storms of life come upon the just and the unjust. That's his point. Notice in verse 2, all things come alike to all. And so there's no discrimination between the good and the evil when it comes to natural disasters or pestilences, tempests or calm, whatever it may be. Jesus said in Matthew 5, verse 45, you know, that he makes it rain, the sun makes it shine on the just and on the unjust. The righteous trust the Lord. And whatever circumstance they find themselves in, the circumstances do not determine your relationship with God. Okay? Just like Job. There's a prime example. What did Job's three friends think about Job because he had faced, because all of the trials that had happened to him? They thought he was an unrighteous man, that there was clearly sin in his life. Look at what God's allowing to happen to him. This is certainly a judgment from God. Were they right or wrong about that? Well, they were wrong. And that's the point that Solomon is making in this text. The righteous trust the Lord in whatever circumstance. Like Job, the wicked don't, but the righteous do. And the circumstances are not indicators of a person's standing with God. So all things come alike to all. Whether you do good or you do evil. Or you are clean or you are unclean. Or you sacrifice, you worship God, or you don't worship God. You know, it's kind of troubling sometimes, you know, if you let yourself get into a carnal mindset, you look around at some of the things that other people have. You know, people who do not give to the work of the Lord, people who do not take the time to worship the Lord, they spend their Lord's days, you know, out on the lake or golfing or whatever it is they want to do. But they seem to be having a very good life. Does that trouble you? Let us not let that affect us. Let us keep our focus and do what's right. And don't think that God accepts their irreverence, because he doesn't. Just because they have a nice life. The circumstances are not indicators of a person standing with God. And the reality is, the suffering are typically those who are serving God. If they're suffering, of course, for serving God. So the good and the bad, the clean, the unclean, him that sacrifices or doesn't sacrifice, the good, so is the sinner, all things come alike. He who takes an oath and he who does not take an oath. Those who take oaths lightly and those who are very reverential in understanding the seriousness of their oath. And the need, as he talked about back in chapter 5, you better make sure that the oath that you take, you keep. It is better not to take an oath than to make an oath and not keep it. And so our attitude towards, you know, what we say is certainly important to God. And we need to keep what we promise. But the reality is, as you look at it from a worldly perspective, life under the sun, you know, the one who doesn't keep his word seems to be doing pretty good for the most part. They sometimes climb up that ladder of success. They're the ones that... they may make president one day. So we need to keep that in mind. In verse 3, he goes on, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live. And after that, they go to the dead. Now, from all appearances under the sun, there is little benefit to living a godly life. If you just were to step back and look at it purely from a materialistic perspective, what benefit is there to doing what's right? What benefit is there to serving God? I mean, I'm talking about purely from a materialistic, worldly perspective. The people of the world, an atheist, for example, will look at those who are sincere, zealous, faithful Christians, and they'll look at you like you're just dumb. Because you're giving all of your time and your energy and your money. You're pouring yourself into your faith. They see that as a huge waste of time and effort that you could be putting into other things. Well, certainly they're misguided. Certainly they're wrong about that. And really Solomon is kind of dealing with that perspective. This is what it looks like. And so it just says, you know, what benefit is there to serving God, living a godly and righteous life? And because of that, many continue in their evil ways. And it goes back to what is stated back in chapter 8 and verse 11. Remember where he said, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in him to do evil. Because there is not this judgment from God. Listen, you know what? If everybody who did what was wrong were punished right then, and they suffered because of that, and everyone who did what was right, well, their bank accounts just, you know, filled up real quick, and everything was happening that's just perfect in their life, you know, there'd be a lot more people serving the Lord. But that's not the way it works. And because an evil person is not punished immediately, their heart is continually set on evil. And so he even points out that, you know, madness is in their hearts while they live. This concept of madness here is a reference to their blind and ignorance regarding spiritual things. They are seeing only the material benefits or lack of benefit in one lifestyle or another, and they're not considering the spiritual ramifications and the consequences of their actions. And so they are blind and they're ignorant, and Solomon says they're mad. They do not see things as they really are. And so like a herd of cattle heading to the slaughter, that's what most of mankind is doing. You know, they're just on their way to their fate, to their end, to their doom. Just blindly following the herd, you know, one after another. And so the end, they go to the dead. And that's, of course, the end of all men. Death comes to all, ready or not. Right? And so Solomon has already emphasized that in chapter 2 and 16, 3, 19, 5, 15, 6, 12. And as we've already pointed out, Hebrews 9, 27. It is appointed unto men once to die, and after this the judgment. Of course, that in the context is technically speaking of Jesus Christ and his suffering once for sins. But it is true. We will all die, unless Jesus comes first, of course. But death comes to all, ready or not. We're all going to go to the dead. But these people are going unprepared. Now in verse 4 he says, but for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. Now the living know that they're going to die. So, you know, you would hope that they would understand that. And they would make the corrections in their life before that time came. While they are alive, there is hope. Of course, the nature and quality of that hope is going to be different from person to person. Because many people, their hope is simply material things. And Solomon here is not so much simply or merely contemplating the hope of life with God and a right relationship in heaven. That's not really his point here. The idea of hope is that of success and benefit. The worldly man looks at it from a materialistic perspective. The spiritual man looks at it from a heavenly perspective. And he lays up for himself treasure in heaven. Whereas the materialistic man, well, he lays up his treasure here on earth. And there's hope that he has while he's living. And as he's living, well, he's seeking to obtain his goals in life. But the reality is, once you're dead, that's it. You're no longer pursuing your goals. There is no more hope. Now, for a spiritually minded person, there is much more than this world and the things of this world. You lay up for yourself treasures in heaven. Okay, so we understand that. But here Solomon's main point is, you know, while there is life, a person is doing what he seeks to do to gratify his desires, whatever they may be. A living dog is better than a dead lion. It's a metaphor. It's an idiom. The vilest creature, the wild dogs of Israel, were despicable creatures. They weren't pets. He's not talking here about a pet. He's talking about the wild dogs, the vile creatures, the unclean animals. But a living lion, I mean, you fear that lion. He is a noble creature. And so even a living, vile creature like a wild dog is better off than a dead lion. Things can never get better for a person in this world if he is dead. Right? He's done. He points out then, for the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. Now, don't take him to be saying here that when you die, you don't know anything, because we know from Luke 16 that that's not the case. We know that the rich man who died, Lazarus died, and then the rich man died, and the rich man lifted up his eyes and he was in torment. He knew where he was. He knew who he was and what he had done, and he knew that he was suffering in that flame. He knew who Lazarus was, and he knew that if Lazarus could just find a drop of water to place on the tip of his tongue, that it would be refreshing to him. That's the torment that he was in. So Solomon's not talking about that. He's talking about one's relationship to this world. The dead know nothing. They are cut off from this world. Job 14, verse 21. You're cut off from this world. You no longer have any dealings in this world. They have no more reward. Listen, no fruit of your labor, Luke 12, is going to be yours. You know that rich man who, in Luke 12, had this great crop come in. And he said, I'm going to build myself bigger barns so I can store all my crops. That was what he contemplated the night he died. Now, how much of the fruit of his labor did he reap? How much of his labor did he get to enjoy? That's Solomon's point here. No fruit for the labor that they've done, for the memory of them is forgotten. Now, here's another terrible thing. With the passing of time, you will be forgotten in this world. You'll be forgotten. People will not know who you are. Now, certainly there are names given in the Bible that we've learned and we remember. And there are many great people that have lived that, you know, in history, that their names have been preserved. But that's just a very few number. And the reality is, and you know, eventually everyone will be forgotten. Some of the great men back in, you know, before the flood, how many of them are going to be remembered? No doubt. You know, Enoch, you got those in the Bible, but there were other people living, you know, who knows how many people. They're all forgotten. You have all the people who have lived, all who have been forgotten. What's going to be your fate when you're gone? You know, my generation and older, we all know who Elvis Presley is. You start talking to some of these young people who, Elvis, you know, have you ever listened to Elvis Presley? Who? Who's that? They don't know. It won't be long. Elvis will be just, you know, a memory that is forgotten by the most folks in the world. So anyhow, the memory of them is forgotten. Their love, their hatred, their envy have now perished. Regardless of what other people thought about them, it's all going to be gone and forgotten eventually. Whether they were good or they were bad, it's all going to be just a memory that fades into the night. All disappear. Never more will they have a share in anything done under the sun. What does that tell you about ghosts? What effect or what dealings do people have after they leave this life? Will they ever have in this world again? None. Okay, so if you're scared of ghosts, don't be. All right? They will have no more dealings in this world anymore. The curtain falls, the role here ends forever. You know what? That's what's going to happen to you and I one day. Our time on this earth is going to come to an end. And we'll just be a memory, which will fade over time. It's kind of gloomy, isn't it? go. But, okay, so how do you deal with this? How do you deal with this understanding? You know, you're just going to die. Everybody's going to forget you. All of your accomplishments are really going to be for naught. How do you deal with that? Look at verse 7. Go, eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Okay? Be up and doing. Go. This is in the form of a command, actually. Don't be sitting around, you know, moping over life's perplexities and life's difficulties and even the end result, which you know is coming. You're eventually going to die. You could be sitting there singing like on Hee Haw, woe is me, you know. You could doom in despair, agony on me. You could be thinking that way. The admonition here is think positively. Enjoy today. Enjoy your family. Enjoy your life. Take the blessings that God has given you, and with moderation, of course, enjoy them. Don't be worrying about the problems with which you actually have no control over. Eat and drink with a merry heart. The idea is, again, is not to riotous living. He's already talked about this in chapter 2, verse 24, and chapter 3, verse 12. So we've already talked about the point not being, you know, you can just go live like you want. Live it up. You know, live a riotous lifestyle if that's what you want. That's not what he's saying. He's simply saying, enjoy the gifts that God has given you. Take advantage of today. Enjoy life. In moderation, yes, but enjoy it. Listen, asceticism would only intensify the gloom that one would experience. You know, you think about some of the ascetic practices of old. You know, they would beat themselves up and put themselves in all kinds of physical pain. They would deprive themselves of food and drink. And of course, now, alcohol, we're not talking about alcohol here. We're not talking about getting drunk. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about enjoying the things of life, the things that are good in and of themselves. Asceticism takes those things away. There is a philosophy that, you know, self-deprivation is the way to holiness. Well, no, that's not true. Now, certainly, we are to deprive ourselves of sinful things. But the things of this life, we can enjoy them. Listen, it's good to go on a hike, and especially in the state of Arkansas, there are so many beautiful things to see. So many beautiful things to enjoy. Go with your family and enjoy the views. Go on the lake. Enjoy it. That's, of course, secondary to your things and your service to God. But enjoy life as you have an opportunity. Enjoy the things in life. Many people, they're just always down in the dumps and they're so sad. Listen, that's no way to live. And Solomon is saying so. Resolve to enjoy all the gifts of God. God has already accepted your works. Now, he's talking about the works. If you go back up to verse 1, and keep this in mind. He's talking about the righteous and the wise, and their works are in the hand of God. So these are the works that he's talking about. God has already accepted your works. You're right. You're wise. You're serving the Lord. So enjoy the things of God. God has accepted you. And what he intends for you is to enjoy the things, the blessings that he does give you in this life. With reverence and thanksgiving, enjoy life. Again, that's not a sinful life. That is a life lived in service to God. Enjoy the blessings that he gives you. And he, you know, a righteous person can truly enjoy God's gifts. He talks about, let your garments always be white. That's pure. That's clean. But it's also a symbol of, you know, of celebration. And let your head lack no oil. You're anointed with the oil. And of course, they use that not only for, you know, personal cleansing, but also for celebration. So a righteous person can only, and only a righteous person can truly enjoy God's gifts, because he truly sees that they are from God. He gives God thanks and he understands the right place for these gifts, puts them in their proper order in life. He doesn't focus on them, does not make them his God. Materialistic things of this world is not his aim,
but he simply enjoys the things that God has given with God in mind, in view, and controlling his life. So, he then gives a specific example. Also, besides the eating and drinking, in verse 9, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your life, your vain life, which he has given you under the sun. Joyfully with the wife whom you love. This world is made so much better by a loving spouse. God understood that when he created man in Genesis chapter 2, verses 18 through 20. He looked down at the man that he created and he said, it is not good that man be alone. So he made for him a helpmeet that was comparable to him. That was God's design from the very beginning. And the wife, the woman, is to be his companion through life. And is to bring him joy, and he is to bring her joy. And of course, when both the husband and the wife are both faithful to the Lord, and they look to the Lord for their instruction and guidance in life, and how to be a good husband and to be a good wife, then that marriage is going to be a wonderful thing. As God intended for it to be. And so the encouragement here is to live joyfully with the wife whom you love. Now again, we talked about this in Bible class this morning. This is our choice. We choose to love. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 23 through 27. Listen, husbands, love your wives even as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. That's your responsibility. And you choose to love your wife. Even when she's not acting like she ought to, you love her anyway. And wives, love your husbands. So, live joyfully with the wife. By the way, the proverb writer makes the same point many times, but Malachi chapter 2 and verse 15, verses 14 through 16, there Malachi is rebuking the children of Israel because they were dealing treacherously with the wives of their youth. They were putting them away, and God is rebuking them for dealing treacherously with the wife of their covenant, their youth, whom they had entered into a covenant with. One man, one woman for life. That is God's plan. It's always been God's plan. It always will be God's plan, regardless of what a man may want to do. One man, one woman for life. And what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. And so Solomon makes that point here. All the days of your life, of vanity. Don't reject the person that God's given you. The enjoyment of life with a good wife is man's portion in this life. That's what he says. For that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. She is your helpmeet. Enjoy life with your wife and with your children. Enjoy life. These are important lessons, I think, for balance. You know, sometimes we can kind of get carried away and we need to be zealous. And, you know, I've also talked to others. I've experienced this and I've talked to others about it. We can become so focused on certain things that pertain to God. And again, we need to put that first. But part of being a good husband is not just studying your Bible and learning the Word of God and teaching others and living your life, neglecting your wife in doing so. That's not what you ought to be doing. That's not being a good husband. Being a good husband, and God designed you to fulfill her needs and to be there for her. You have a responsibility to your wife. So don't forsake your wife and say, well, I'm doing God's work in the process. Something to remember. But she is the portion of your life, and to enjoy life. Work while it is today. Notice verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you're going. And that, by the way, balance is important in life, whether it's with family and serving God and all the things that you're engaged in life. Do what is set before you while you have an opportunity to do it.
Because the time is going to come when you will no longer have that opportunity. Work while it is day. You know, Paul says in Ephesians 4 and verse 28, to work so that you may give to those who have need. You work. Laziness leads to ruin. Hard work leads to success, typically speaking, although he'll turn that around in just a minute. But that is the idea. You work hard regardless, because you don't know what's going to happen in the future, and you don't know the circumstances that you're going to find yourself in, but work hard anyway. And the kingdom, of course, is worth working for. We need to give our efforts and our time for the kingdom while it is today. Seek Him first, and all these other things will fall into place. In Matthew 6 and verse 33, seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all of these things will be added to you. Time is of the essence, in other words. John 9:4, the hour is coming when no man can work. Jesus was a master at utilizing His time. He still took time for His disciples and for those whom He was responsible for. He still had time to do the things for His Father in heaven as well. And He was a master at utilizing His time. We need to perhaps work on that a little bit more in our culture today, which robs us so quickly and easily of our time. We need to be better stewards of our time and take advantage of the opportunities that we have to do those things that are most important. Sometimes we have to decide what is most important in life, and instead of focusing on the urgent things of life, we need to focus on the things that are important in life, the most valuable things. But every opportunity to do good, we must take advantage of those. Galatians 6 and verse 10. So work while it is day. Take advantage of the time that you have, the blessings that God has given you. Because here's a reality again. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill. But time and chance happen to them all. We don't know what's going to happen in life. There may be someone who is on their fast track, man, to success. Maybe it's the best football player in the world. And best basketball player in the world. I mean, they're the number one draft pick in the NBA. Set to make all kinds of money. And before draft day, they blow out their knee and they're never able to play again. You never know what's going to happen. Point in all this is that human ability and resources do not guarantee success in this life. I want to emphasize that again. Solomon is not talking about spiritual things. He's talking about material things. He's emphasizing that. You can work hard. You can focus on the things of this world all you want, but you do not govern the circumstances that can destroy everything that you have. You don't have a thing to do with that. Out of our control. Success is conditioned by various laws of chance. Yeah, I said it. Chance. There are unexpected results. Listen, you get on the interstate going home or wherever it is that you're going from here this evening. You don't know what's going to happen. You know, there is not a single person, there's not a single person that has gotten up one morning, gotten all their makeup on, women, of course, getting their makeup on, or men, you know, they're getting ready, they get in their vehicle and they head to work and they've had a fatal accident. Not a one of them got out of bed that morning thinking and planning to have that accident. Not a one. You don't know what's going to happen. And those accidents do not just happen to the wicked, do they? They happen to the godly too. Time and chance happens to them all. A disease may come upon you unexpectedly. You may be going along in perfect health all of your life, and then all of a sudden one day you go to the doctor because you've got this little pain. And I've got had a friend in Pine Bluff. He was fine. He went to the doctor, and in a week he was dead. because he was eaten up with cancer and he didn't even know it. You never know. Time and chance happens to them all. You can eat right, take vitamins, exercise regularly, and still have a heart attack. Time and chance happens to them all. So, for man also does not know his time. We don't know. Thus, we need to be ready all the time. Like a fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare. You know, if you've ever been fishing, you know, poor fish. Have you ever thought about it like that? That poor fish. No, you're thinking, look at that big one I got. And your mouth starts watering, you're thinking about that. That's the way you think about it. But that's not the way the fish thinks about it. But now Solomon is saying, we're like a fish taken in a cruel net. You don't know when that's going to happen. You'd be swimming along minding your business and see a worm and grab it, and next thing you know, you're in a frying pan. Don't let that happen to you. But we don't know what's going to happen in our life as far as the things outside us are concerned. Life, like birds caught in a snare, so the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. Don't prepare for it. You see, we cannot know the future. All we can do is live each day in our service to God, putting the Lord first, living a life that brings glory and honor to Him. And regardless of what happens in life, regardless of whether we succeed materially or we fail miserably materially, we're broke or we're rich, whatever our condition may be in this life, God had better be the center of it, or it really doesn't matter. Makes no difference in the end. We're going to be lost and we're going to be condemned. Life on this earth is going to end. That ought to motivate all of us to prepare wisely, to meet God. One of these days, Amos even says, prepare to meet thy God, talking to Israel. We need to take that same warning and we need to take it seriously. Prepare to meet thy God. The day is going to come when you and I are going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ and give an account for the things that we've done in our body, whether they be good or bad. The day is coming when we are going to be judged by the Lord, and we are going to be, God's not going to be partial. He's going to judge us according to the things that we've done. There is no partiality with the Lord. You can't buy your way out of it. You can't bribe Him. You're going to be judged for how you lived your life. Whether you've trusted Him and submitted to His will and obeyed Him, received the pardon that's in Christ Jesus or not, you're going to stand before Him one of these days. And remember, death is coming. It is appointed unto men once to die. And after this, the judgment. Are we living a life preparation for that day? That day is coming. We don't know when that's going to be. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. You know, Jesus also suffered death. He suffered death on the cross for us. He was crucified by wicked men. He was taken down from that cross and buried in the ground for 3 days. On the third day, He was raised again, giving victory, giving us victory over death. His victory ensures our victory. And if we're faithful to Him, we will live with Him forever and ever. Listen, our choice is, will we follow Christ or not? That's really our choice. And so all the things we talk about in Ecclesiastes, this life and the vanity of it, all the things under the sun that are worthless when you really look at it, it's all just chasing after the wind. Jesus makes life worthwhile. And Jesus, if we follow Him, will give us life everlasting, where there is no death, there is no hardship, and certainly there is no vanity there. If you're not in Christ tonight, you need to get into Him by faith and be baptized in His name for the remission of your sins, that you may be raised to walk in newness of life with a hope of heaven when you die. That's your choice. Are you prepared? If not, let us help you while together we stand and while we sing.